people read it and decide for themselves.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Collector's Corner, the supplementary edition of the Divine Treasury. On the Collector's Corner, we try to talk to somebody who is involved behind the scenes on the things that we all like to collect. Or in some cases, we'll even talk to those who do grading of items that we collect, maybe someone who authenticates them. But in this case, we're talking to New York Times bestselling author Dayton Ward. Dayton has been involved in all aspects of Trek, it seems like, from the Vanguard series to Corps of Engineers series, original series, TNG, Discovery, and he's even dabbled in the Mirror Universe. So welcome to the Collector's Corner, Dayton. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. This is definitely an interesting side for me. Reading the novels is something that takes me back to when I was a kid in elementary school, and I was trying to get through these novels, and it was just a level above where I really was. But I loved the artwork on them, and every now and then I'd get grabbed by something in it and I could get through a book. I guess for me, so you started off in 98 with a short story, Reflections, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So how did that come about for you?
Well, I'd been a reader of Star Trek books back to the 70s because I was in elementary school in the 70s. So my first Star Trek books were the James Blish adaptations or the Alan Dean Foster adaptations of the cartoon, and the odd original novel that came out back in those days. And then when pocketbooks got the license in conjunction with the first movie, they started publishing on a regular basis. Like, I think it was 6 books a year. So every other month, and I would buy them, every other month I'd pick them up. And then as the films continued and Next Gen came along, Pocket added books to each of those, to their lineup to reflect the new series. So they were publishing, at that point, a book a month, one for Next Gen and one for TOS. They'd alternate. And then the schedule started to get a little hectic when DS9 and Voyager came along. And by that point I was volunteering as a moderator on the old America Online Star Trek Club, the message boards there. And one of the areas that I oversaw was publishing. So books, comics, games, stuff like that. And I was already interested in that stuff already. So I was a moderator and I liked hanging out with the same people who liked, people who liked the same stuff. And one of the editors from Pocketbooks, John Ordover, hung out there and answered questions about what was coming up, who was going to write a book, what this book was going to be about. And that's where I learned about the Strange New Worlds writing contest, which he announced on America Online. And basically it was, send us your Star Trek short stories. Here's the guidelines for what we want and what we can't use. And the ones that we pick, we'll pay you for them and we'll publish them. So I was sort of convinced by a friend to submit a story because I've been writing stories already just for fun. So she convinced me to submit a story for that first contest. And lo and behold, it was one of the ones they picked. They even announced the winners on America Online in a live chat back in late 97. So the contest ran during 97 and the book was published in the summer of 98. So I got my story in this anthology. They paid me. It was a professional writing credit, my first one. And that was the whole idea, was this contest was for unpublished writers. So you could have no more than 2 published short stories in a professional venue to be eligible for the contest. So my first story. And then I repeated that the next 2 years with the contest. And so I basically rendered myself ineligible to enter the contest because now I'm a quote professional writer, unquote. And John Ordover, who was still working as an editor at Pocket, asked me if I was interested in writing a Star Trek novel for him, for Pocket Books. And I had never written anything longer than a short story in my life. So of course I said, sure, that sounds like a great idea. What could possibly go wrong? So I got a contract. I wrote an outline. He sent me a contract. I got paid and I spent a better part of the year. I think it was 2000. I spent writing that book and it was published in early 2002. And I've been writing for Pocket Books or Simon and Schuster ever since.
So can you kind of walk me through that process of developing a novel from, you know, from inception and like, right. Can you kind of walk me through that?
Well, so the idea is, when it comes to books like Star Trek novels or Star Wars novels or books based on video games, or you have to submit an outline to the editor at the publishing house who has the rights for these things. And they vet it and they tell you what's wrong with it and where to fix it. And then they submit that package to the licensing people at the studio, the people who own Star Trek or Star Wars or whatever. So in this case, it was at that time, it was Viacom Consumer Products. So they get a look at the outline and they decide they like it. And they make suggestions if appropriate on what they would rather see or rather not see. And then once you get the green light from the studio, that's when you start to write the novel. And you, depending on the person and the situation, you know, that the amount of time you might have to write that novel varies. My very first one, they didn't even schedule it for publication until they had it and they reviewed it and they decided it was up to snuff. Then I got put on the publication schedule. Nowadays, they know pretty much when I'm going to write one and when it's going to be published. And I get like 4 months to write the book after the outline's been approved. But back in those days, so after I write the outline or the manuscript, I would send it to the editor. I get my notes back from the editor. I make any changes or fixes or, you know, other adjustments that they've asked for. And then it goes to the studio and they get to read it and weigh in on it. And back in those days, I didn't have a direct line to the people at licensing. They would talk to the editor at Simon & Schuster, send back their notes via fax. I still have a copy of the fax for this first book in a folder with the contract work and all other stuff. So I get the notes, I make the changes to the manuscript, they send it all back and it gets reviewed and approved. And then, you know, I get my final payment for the manuscript, for the contract, and then eventually it's published. So the whole cycle can take anywhere from 18 to 24 months on average. It's a little more accelerated these days, but back in those days, you could count on 18 months easy from time I put in my submission to, you know, here's my idea for a Star Trek novel to being published.
I mean, do you feel like, over the years, that, you know, editors have given you more leeway, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know probably when you first start out and you weren't established yet, you know, you're probably getting a lot of, you know, edits and corrections. And I mean, is it more of that you feel like that they trust you more now, or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years now. And the people who actually, one of the people who vets the manuscripts at CBS has been doing it for just about the same amount of time. So we've known each other that entire time. And since social media came along and we all have this more immediacy in being able to talk to each other, instead of me routing information through the editor and the editor sends it to the licensor and it might wind its way back, the guy that reads my manuscripts, you know, gives me grief on Twitter. You know? And so we'll talk back and forth. And so there's that more of immediacy, but there is a level of trust over time, and over the years, you know, that trust has expanded. And we also know the writers who do these books, they know what the studio is expecting, you know, where the lines are, which lines we can and can't cross, where the gray areas are, how much latitude we have. And they know that the editors are not going to send them anything that they're not necessarily going to reject out of hand. They might have questions, they might have suggestions on things that they would rather us do differently or tweak it a little bit because they know about something that's in production that might impact what we're working on. But yes, we have enjoyed a great degree of latitude. It's particularly in recent years.
So with the changes, not only at the studio where, you know, you go from Paramount to CBS to now CBS, Viacom, Paramount, whatever it is that they're going by now. And then by the same token, going from Pocket to Simon & Schuster, I mean, is there a huge difference in how things operate for you, or does it kind of remain the same in Not each really. Avenue?
Well, I mean, on the publishing side, Simon & Schuster is the company and Pocket Books was an imprint that did paperback novels, and then they did stuff like the Star Trek novels. And now that the paperbacks have become the larger size paperbacks, we call them trade paperbacks now. Mm-hmm. That's a different imprint at Simon & Schuster called Gallery Books. But yeah, it's the same people. It's the same editors. I mean, I've worked with the same editor at Simon & Schuster now for over 15 years. And so, again, there's that level of trust and expectations. Like, okay, I give Dayton you know, I give Dayton a project, I can hopefully count on, hopefully he can count on me to do it right. You know, or at least that's what I hope he's thinking. And the same thing with the people of licensing, even though it became, it was Viacom licensing, or, you know, Viacom consumer products, then it became CBS consumer products. And now it's Viacom CBS consumer products. It's the same people working in that office. They've been there. John Van Sitters has been in that office for over 20 years. He's gotten promoted to a point where he's a, he was one person working in the office. Now he runs the office. Now he runs the division that owns the office, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's the same guy and it's the same people. And they're not just like accountants or bean counters. They are hardcore Star Trek fans. John Van Sitters is one of the most hardcore Star Trek fans I know. And so the idea that you're going to get something over on them because, well, they don't know the property, I can probably slide a reference in. No, they'll totally catch you every time. Mm-hmm. So, but there's a level of familiarity, which makes this job very easy because you can communicate in a shorthand almost because we're familiar with the properties. I don't have to explain every little detail. You know, this is referenced in this episode and it happened with this character. You know, he knows what I'm talking about before I'm even finished talking. He knows where I'm going. So it's a lot of fun. There's, like I said, it's over time that we've enjoyed that degree of trust and latitude. You had to earn it, obviously.
So for the 50th anniversary, you worked on the Legacies trilogy. Mm-hmm. Was that a concept that was brought to the three of you in that project, or was that something that they talked to the three of you and said, we'd like you to get together on a series, hash out what you can and bring it back to us?
It was the latter. It was actually four of us, cause I did my book with my co-writer, Kevin. But John Van Sitters wanted some kind of project for the 50th anniversary, and he had his ideas on who he wanted to write the books. And so once they assembled the team, which was myself, Kevin, and then David Mack and Greg Cox were the other writers on their two books, we sat down together, the four of us, and hashed out a storyline that would drive a trilogy and each individual book. So yeah, but that, as far as the story, we came up with the story. They, in response to their request for some kind of big event, mm-hmm. for the we originally envisioned it as four books. I think we tried to get one more writer in there, but that didn't work out, so it had to be a trilogy. So once we figured that out, then we tooled it for three books and then figured out who was going to write which book in which order and who was going to do what, and how we were going to carry the storyline across these three books. It was a lot of fun, but again, a lot of trust. They just said, give us something cool for the 50th, go. Mm-hmm.
What is it like to kind of co-author with other people? Like, what's that process like when you're, you know, maybe when you're doing a book with Kevin or perhaps doing a series with David Mack, like how does that interplay?
There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of communication, a lot of emails, a lot of phone calls. If the timing is right, we might even be able to talk, you know, face to face at a convention where we'll spend the good part of an evening hashing out what's next. That's what we did a lot of times with Vanguard. We usually had what we laughingly referred to as a Vanguard summit every summer, because all of us plus our editor would be at the convention. So we'd all go to dinner and we talk about what's next with Vanguard, you know, and we'd map it out. And in fact, that's how we figured out how we were going to wrap up that series, was going to dinner and the five of us, you know, talking, or the four of us talking about how we were going to do this.
So I'm thinking along the lines of the A Time 2 series as well. There was 9 books and 6 of you writing.
Yeah, but that was a little different because we were not in the original lineup for those books. Okay. Kevin and I, there was a different set of writers, and I think the original plan was 12 books, and then they whittled it down to 10 books. Jeez. And then the ninth and 10th book became one book. Mm-hmm. And, but all that happened before Kevin and I were even involved. It was a different writer that they had offered the third and fourth books to, and that writer stepped away from the project for reasons that I don't know. So late in 2002, like right over Christmas 2002, John Ordover, who was the editor at the time, called me and said, are you guys interested in writing these two books for this series? And this marked basically our elevation from the minor leagues to the starting lineup on the major leagues roster. Cause we had been doing the Corps of Engineers novellas at that point, but we had never written, other than the one novel I had already written by myself. This was our first novel gig together, Kevin and I. So, he asked us to write an outline for a couple of books, And as the other writers had already written their outlines and were already working on their storylines, we were kind of hemmed in a little bit on what we could and couldn't do. Because he laughingly said, all right, so the first two books take place in space and books five and six take place on a planet. So don't set your story in either of those two places. And so we're like, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the conversation. So Kevin and I very hastily wrote an outline that we thought would cover two books so that we could get going. And we were partway writing through the first book, and I'm looking at the outline, and we're meeting on a Saturday, and I'm like, I don't think we've got enough meat for two books. we need another subplot. So we basically pulled a subplot out of You Can Name Your Favorite Orifice. And that's how we managed to fill out those two books. In hindsight, I think it would have worked better as one book. But that was our first time playing at that level, so to speak, for the game. They brought us to the show. But that was sort of like, after that, that's when the novel contracts started coming more regularly. Like I was more frequently asked if I was interested in writing another Star Trek novel, and that became almost an annual thing at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the first time I can remember where it was such a big event, so to speak, where it was just like bang, bang, bang. You know, it was just a long continuation of that plot from the end of Insurrection to the beginning of Nemesis,
right,
where we're getting this backstory, but it's not just a couple of books, you know, like a trilogy. It's a huge series of events going on, and it all gets wrapped up in the end, and everything just kind of seems to work together. I don't know. I've read the series probably two or three times over the course of time, and I don't know. Maybe you feel that as the author that they should be together, but I didn't find any issue with it. So,
no, thank you. That's just me. I mean, it was just like I said, it was our first time, and the circumstances under which we were brought in were kind of hectic. That's not typically how it goes. We usually have a little more lead time to develop a storyline properly, and we're not having and without operating under so many constraints. Because we were, you know, the third and fourth books of a 9-book series, and the other books were already underway. So it's like we had to slot in with minimal disruption, not just for us, but for the other authors who were already hard at work. So that's not typically how it works. But like I said, it came along at a time when Kevin and I were still kind of figuring out our collaborative process, because we had been doing the novellas for the Corps of Engineers and short stories here and there, but that was really our call up from the miners, was that project.
That's so cool. Now, I know, you know, we've talked to you before, you said you're a big original series fan. Is when it comes to writing books, do you love writing in the original series timeframe, or do you like some of the others, like Next Gen? Like which is your favorite to actually write in?
If I had to pick one, And that was the one I had to write from now on, I'd probably stick with the original show, or, you know, the original characters, the original series characters. And whether it's a set there in the show or set in the movies, I don't know. But I do like writing the Next Gen characters. I particularly like writing Picard and some of the other characters that we created that were created for the novels that, you know, that sort of came in to replace characters who have moved on. You know, like Riker got promoted at the end of Nemesis, so he's a captain on his own ship, and Deanna Troi went with him, and Data. If you saw the movie, you know what happened to Data. So there were characters that were created to fill those gaps in the crew. And so it's fun to write those kind of books, because you're not, at the time we were not constrained by, there's a movie in production, there's a TV show in production. And you talk about the latitude that licensing gave us. They gave us a tremendous amount of latitude. We could do not anything we wanted, but we had far more leeway to do stuff with the characters than we would have ever enjoyed while there was a show in production or a film in production. So we got to do, you know, we got to advance careers and marry people off. And in a couple of rare, you know, circumstances, characters were killed, you know, and then they got brought back because that's Star Trek. But things that would never have allowed to happen, you know, lasting consequences and story arcs that, you know, character arcs that go across multiple books, sometimes covering several years to realize that plot line. It was a tremendous amount of fun. So because of that, I was able to do things with the Next Gen crew that I couldn't necessarily do with the original crew. I've got this original character that we created So now I can tell the point, and I can tell the story through that character's eyes and from that character's point of view. So it freshens things up a little bit. Like, okay, I know how Picard's going to react in a situation because we've seen him do it 100 times on TV, you know, but character X might react a little differently. So I get a chance to do that and kind of mix up, flip the script a little bit.
Yeah, I was, and you touched on it there and what you were saying. I feel like it's that period of time where the novels for the shows and the movies that everyone was used to watching, because they weren't in production anymore, it became like this major serialized story that, mm-hmm. like you said, covered a series of novels, a number of years. It made it fun. That was, if you want to coin a phrase, that was the dark ages of Star Trek, when there was nothing on TV from 04 to 09, and all you had was the novels. And so that was your foray into the universe. And so you had that continuous plot line that you were able to follow.
We tried to make the books accessible, but you know, you had multiple storylines going that could cover multiple books. And then, you know, DS9 characters might show up in a next gen book, or, you know, Voyager might show up in a next gen book, or, you know, whatever. Or we'd have a mini series that would bring elements from all these different shows together for, you know, 4 or 5 books. And then the, whatever happened in that mini series would have ramifications in future storylines. And they let us do it. I mean, very rarely were we told you can't do that, or we prefer that you not do that. It was pretty rare, because, you know, at the time, the idea that we would ever revisit these characters on TV would never, ever, 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 ever going to happen again. We're never going to see the next gen characters on TV ever again. We promise. You sure. know, right? Yeah. So, and then here we are in 2019 or 2020, and then we have Star Trek Picard. So, you know, that presents its own logistical challenge. It's like, well, now what do we do? So it's been a tremendous amount of fun. And they also let us do things like create entire series that aren't even based on one of the shows. It's here's a ship, a brand new ship, and a whole new set of characters that have nothing to do with one of the shows. So, you know, the gloves are even a little more off, because, or the leash is even more loose, because we don't have to worry about, I can kill all these characters and start again in the next book if I want to use an extreme example. But we're not tied to the canon of a particular show, because we have a little more latitude. So it's kind of, and I hate to, you know, pardon the pun, the best of both worlds, where you get to play in a sandbox, but you have all these new toys to play with.
So this is where I'm going to go completely off the rails here and break some of our rules.
Oh, no way.
All right. I notice you're a big Rush fan. I'm a huge Rush fan.
Okay.
So I've noticed some of your titles of some of your stories are Rush songs. You want to talk about that at all?
It's been known to happen. David Mack is also a huge Rush fan. In fact, I'd argue he's a bigger Rush fan than I am. Because we had a little thing going on for, you know, who could name the most stories after Rush songs or something. I think I've edged him out. I might be one or two ahead of him, but there was a while there where we were going at each other pretty well. And I don't do it every time, but I do have a list, you know, of all the songs, and I've got marks next to the ones I think make good story titles. If I can come up with a storyline and one of those titles will fit, then I absolutely will go that way. And, I've also included other subtle Rush references in different stories. Like, I think, you know, we talk about the planet Syrinx 3 and the temples that you can find there and things like that.
That's great.
So it's just one of those weird things. I mean, you're either a Rush fan or you're not. I don't think there's really any middle ground. There might be the one guy who knows the 4 songs they play on the radio, but you either like Rush or you don't like Rush. I don't know.
Well, I saw that savage post that you had today about Russia's birth control.
Man, that was harsh. It was harsh. I laughed through the whole thing.
I did too. So, I'll have to send that to you, Jamie, so that you can take a look at it.
My wife is a huge Rush fan too, so I have a hard time squaring that with the fact that we're both Rush fans and have been forever.
Mm.
That's great.
One of the things you talked about is kind of, I don't want to say getting painted into a box, but it's almost kind of like that, where you can't go off canon on stuff that's already been put there, but you were involved in the second Discovery novel that was put out, correct?
Yeah, I wrote the second one.
The second one. Okay. I wanted to make sure I had the number right. Yep. So you were dealing with events that happened in TOS, but you were able to incorporate characters that were now coming into play in Discovery. How much fancy footwork was involved there when it came to working with what was going to be happening on TV versus what was going to be going into your book?
That was different. It was a challenge. When I was asked if I was interested in writing the novel, you know, the show had not aired. They were still figuring it out. They hadn't started filming yet. In fact, and I didn't even have it as hard as Dave Mack did. He wrote the first book and he took that bullet right in the chest. They had nothing or very little information. They were still figuring it out. And even to a lesser degree, they were doing that while I was working on an outline for what became my book. Thankfully, Kirsten Beyer, who was a writer on the show at the time, was the conduit. She was the liaison between the writer's room and licensing and the publisher. So we could go to her with questions, and she was very, very, very helpful in telling us where we could go and where we couldn't go. And it was with her that we settled on the idea of incorporating some TOS lore into my book. And the idea of making it a prequel to the show. Cause I set my book 10 years before the beginning of Discovery's first season. As far as the decision to set it on Tarsus IV, that was one of the places that she hit on quickly. I think I wrote down 3 or 4 ideas on where it could be set, and she liked the Tarsus IV idea. So then it became a tap dance on how do I make sure I don't violate what the original episode established and, you know, tell a story for Discovery and yet have it make sense in the 21st century. Because, you know, when the original episode was aired in the 60s, nobody even knew what DNA was. And of course, mm-hmm. now every episode of every crime show uses DNA to solve a crime.
Yep.
And, you know, so how did this guy fake his death? You know, how did this guy have a body burnt beyond recognition that when they look at it with 23rd century medical technology still figures out that it must be him? You know, how did he convince them? And how do I explain that to an audience 50 years later? Because we all watch CSI and we all think we're awesome, you know, forensics guys and stuff. So I had to figure out a way to thread that needle and have it make sense and yet still honor what was in the original show, the original episode, which was a lot of fun. I think I did okay. You know, the readers get to make the decision on whether I did it or not. But I thought I did it well, good enough to get by. But it was a lot of fun. It was challenging because, you know, they hadn't even cast Lorca when I started writing. Jason Isaacs had not been cast. And in fact, she called me. I was on a way to a convention with Kevin. We were in the car on our way from Kansas City to Denver when she called me to let me know that they had cast Jason Isaacs. And I'm like, okay, cool. I know Jason Isaacs. I've seen him in other things. And I had an idea of how I could write his mannerisms. And I'm thinking they're going to play him, you know, because he's a Brit. And I'm like, okay, he'll be British. He'd be like a Picard light, you know, or something. And then they come back and tell me, no, they're going to make him a Southern guy. He's going to have like a Southern drawlish thing. And he was literally on stage that afternoon going through his first paces with the first script where he's in it. Like it was the third episode, right? So he's literally working out with the director how he's going to come across on screen, his mannerisms and what his catchphrase is going to be and all this other kind of stuff. And so I had to go back and rewrite like the first third of my book.
Oh man.
To conform to, you know, this idea, which is fine because I knew that was going to be a thing anyway. I mean, this wasn't a surprise. I knew something like this could happen because of where I was in the development cycle of the show and where my book was being written. So, by the time I had a manuscript delivered and approved, it was still before the show aired. I think because Dave's book was timed to come out right before the show or right after the first episode. And mine was timed to come out after the big reveal about Lorca in season one. For those, in case there's people out there who have yet to watch the show, I don't want to spoil it, but so they timed it for that. So right after that big reveal, I think my book came out a week later or something. I don't remember exactly how it timed out, but I knew about the twists. I knew about all that stuff because I'd read all the scripts and I'd seen some early production art. So I had been spoiled on the whole season in script form. Mm-hmm. And even then I still got a few surprises because they made some changes in editing and all that kind of stuff. But so that was the only, that's the first time I'd ever written a book based on a show that was in active production. All the other stuff like original series and Next Gen and all that were all, you know, they were all long off the air when I started doing this.
Well, and you put that little Easter egg about Lorca at the end too, correct?
Yeah, that was Kirsten's idea.
Was it?
Full credit to Kirsten. She came up with the idea of a post. She came up with the idea of a stinger at the end of the book to show the real Lorca and where he might be. And it was my idea to put it at the very end of the book. So like a post-credit scene at the end of a Marvel flick. So the lights are getting ready to come up, or you think that the credits are gone, the lights are going to come up, but the lights stay down and they show you one more scene. That was my idea. I said, just put it in the back and don't even explain it. Just let's see how long it takes for people to figure it out. So there may very, very well be people who have read the book and never got to that part. I don't know. I've heard rumors, but I've never actually come across anybody who failed to have read that part.
Now, I know you've done some mirror universe stuff as well. Do you like playing in the mirror universe, or you prefer kind of staying in the prime universe?
I've done it a couple of times, but it's been a while. The first time we did it, we were invited by another editor at Simon & Schuster, Margaret Clark, who was editing. It was her and another editor, Marco Palmieri, were each editing a collection of three short novels, all set in the mirror universe. And the first one was an Enterprise story, and it was originally based on Mike Sussman's treatment for what would have been a fifth season episode of Enterprise, a sequel to their mirror universe episodes. So he originally was asked to write this novel, this short novel. And at some point in the process, it became a situation where he wanted some help. So in the form of people who actually wrote novels. It was his first time he trying to write a novel, and he was encountering some difficulty, I think. So Margaret asked Kevin and I if we were interested in teaming up with Mike Sussman to write this novel based on his treatment. So we ended up working with Mike and, you know, showing him how, okay, this works on TV, but we got to fill in gaps between scenes. We got to have bridging material to have it all flow and make sense like a novel. So here's where we did. So Kevin and I did a lot of that work. That was fun. It was the first time I'd done a mirror universe story. And you know, the fun part is they're familiar characters, but you get to go off the chain a little bit with them and do all the crazy stuff that, you know, normal civilized people wouldn't do. You know, there's a lot more blood, a lot more violence, a lot less morals. So yeah, it was fun. And then that led to the short story collection we did with, our pitch was Robert April in the mirror universe. And our pitch to the editor was, what if he's Harvey Keitel's character from Pulp Fiction? You know, the cleaner, the guy that comes in to clean up the mess, you know, when Travolta and Sam Jackson, you know, they shoot the guy in the back of the car and the car's all bloody and everything. So I got, what if it's Bob April, the cleaner from Pulp Fiction in the mirror universe? So he's even more sadistic than Harvey Keitel's character was. And that was the pitch. And they say, okay, go write that. So that's what we ended up doing. A lot of fun.
That's funny stuff. It's always cool to hear the backstory as to how all of this stuff came to fruition.
I want to ask one more question. Kirk Fu, how did that come about?
I was working with that publisher, Inside Editions. They had hired me to write a travel guide about Vulcan, the planet. That book was based on actual travel guides. I basically used the real world travel guides like Lonely Planet or Froters or whatever. And I wrote a book about Vulcan and all the cool places that you go when you're on vacation there. And while I was finishing that up, I had this idea about a parody of military hand-to-hand combat manuals, but it was based on Kirk's fighting style from the show. And I wrote up a pitch of like 2 or 3 pages. And I sent it to my editor and he wrote me back like within 30 minutes. He says, I'm not even halfway through the first page and I want this now. And so I was like, okay, now I got to really make this work. It took a while for the planets to align and opening on the schedule, but I basically pitched it as a step-by-step diagram that if you follow these instructions, you can fight like Captain Kirk. And of course, in reality, if you fight like Captain Kirk, you're probably going to get your butt kicked. But the idea for me was I would be the straight man with the text that I wrote. I would play it completely straight, oblivious to how absurd this is, and, you know, seriously describe and diagram all the moves. And then the art is what would sell the joke, you know, how absurd some of these fighting moves are. And so I knew that it would all rest on the artist they picked. And I literally wrote the manuscript for the book before the first drawing was done. So I had a lot of notes to the artist in the margins and stuff. And, you know, and then once they hired an artist, I started collaborating with them via email or through the editor via email about what we should see and how they should look. And, you know, again, my text is completely serious and straight. All the absurdity gets carried in the drawings. And I think it turned out even better than I envisioned, in my head when I was pitching this silly idea. And admittedly, it is kind of goofy, but it was just one of those things. I sort of like just said, well, I'll pitch it. And the worst they can say is no, you know, and, lo and behold, there we go.
And you got held to it.
Yeah. And now my dream is to be able to put a copy of that book in William Shatner's hand. So we will see if I get to pull that off later this year.
And once we're back at cons. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's fast forward now to present day. On the docket is Coda Book One, which is by you. Moments Asunder is the title. And it's a uniting of the Enterprise and Picard, the Robinson, I'm assuming, with Sisko, the Aventine with Ezri Dax, and the Titan with Will Riker. And what I see on Simon & Schuster's website right now is that the trilogy begins when an unexpected arrival of an old friend triggers a desperate mission to avert a fast-spreading temporal disaster. So how big of an epic is this trilogy going to be?
Pretty big, pretty epic. It's going to be big. This is something that we've been planning for the better part of 2 years. Back in early 2018 is when I first learned about them bringing Patrick Stewart back for Picard. So well before the Vegas announcement, I was already kind of in the cone of silence because of my working on the Discovery book. And I knew that bringing back the show, and I had no idea what form the show was going to take. We just knew that Picard and Patrick Stewart specifically were coming back, but we had no idea what they were going to do. But we knew, those of us who do the books, knew that it would impact what we were doing in the books somehow. We just didn't, you know, we had no information. And then as their development of that show proceeded and I was in the loop on things, I started to get information from Kirsten Beyer again, who guided me through that stuff. And I started to see the picture of how the show was going to, not so much the show itself, but also the backstory they were layering in on what happened between, you know, Star Trek Nemesis and the first episode of the new show. So there's that 15 or 16 year gap. And knew how it would play versus what we've been doing with the books in that very same period of time. So once it started to crystallize a little bit, that's when I got in touch with Dave Mack, and we started talking ideas and possibilities and plot nuggets and possibilities. And as we got more information from Kirsten on the show side of things, it helped solidify our attack plan on how we could push forward the books and what they've been doing. And then we brought in Jim Swallow, because they said they wanted a trilogy to do this. And, so 2 years ago, it's been two summers ago now, cause 2019, that's when Dave and I really sat down armed with the knowledge of what they were going to do on the show and said, okay, here's what we can do. And here's what we can't do. Here's where we can go. Here's where we can't go. This is what's going to be impacted. So we started basically taking a bunch of notes. And then once we roped in Jim, we started having Skype calls on a fairly regular basis, and we would hash out storylines. And then when they finally gave us the official word to go, that's when we really got started on, okay, here's a storyline to drive three books. Here's all the things that we want to try to include in one of these three books or all these three books. And then it became a matter of, all right, I'm going to take this plot line. I'm going to take, you know, these, and you're going to take that plot line, and we're going to marry in the middle, and I'm going to hand off the baton at this point, and we're going to use these characters, and we're going to incorporate this bit of plot storyline that's already hanging out there from previous novels. And you do this, I'll do that. We'll, you know, and then we helped each other with our outlines and we presented the entire thing to the publisher as a package, the three outlines. And then all that got approved by the studio, CBS, Viacom CBS. And so we started writing late summer 2020 is when I started writing my book. And Dave started shortly after me. And I think Jim got a later start because he's much more in demand than Dave and I are. I had turned in my book in middle of February. And in fact, the copy edited version is sitting on my hard drive right now, waiting for me to address all the notes so I can return the manuscript back to the publisher, which I'll be doing over the next week and change. And then, you know, before you know it, it'll be September and the book will be on shelves. But yeah, it's a big deal. Been going on for a long time. My world has been that a large degree for the last 2 years.
Yeah. So from what I understand and listening to what you're saying, it seems like it's tying up the prior Star Trek literary universe and preparing it for what is, or at least the 24th century Star Trek literary universe, and preparing it for what's coming now with the current series on TV. That's what it sounds like.
You can think anything you want, but I'm not going to tell you anything. So you can think whatever you want.
Jim, you mentioned Jim Swallow. So he just published the second Picard novel. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing having some of that there is kind of maybe, well, I'll say it anyway, but I'm sure I'm going to get I can't tell you that, but it probably helped influence what he was putting into his novels, I'm guessing. His novel, rather, his piece of the story.
You can conjecture all you want. I'm not going to shoot you down. I'm not going to prop you up. You may think whatever you wish.
Awesome.
You'll find out in October when his book comes out.
So your part one is Jim part two and Dave part three? Okay. Yep. I'm looking forward to that. So on that note, we'll say everyone head to your local bookstores, head to Audible, head to Amazon.com, pick up Moments Asunder, Star Trek Coda, the first part of that trilogy of books that is in September.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about it, which is fine because it's kind of hard to tiptoe around and stuff. But I mean, I work as a consultant for CBS,
right,
on the merchandising side, on the consumer product side. So, you know, I've got my fingers in all sorts of stuff, comics and books and games and other merchandise and other experiences. The idea is they call it brand development. So anything that's enhances the fan experience, but is not related directly to a TV or a film, is where these guys live. So, you know, it could be, you know, there's ideas for theme park attractions and museum exhibits and interactive exhibits and, you know, games, VR games and things like that, that are all being discussed. And then of course, you know, the novels and the books and the role-playing games and the computer games and things like that. So my day is basically all Star Trek all the time. I sometimes post a picture of my user pick on Facebook is the controller from Spock's brain. That's me. So
that's not a bad, it's not a bad gig if you can get paid for it.
It's not a bad gig and they pay me pretty decently.
But you're a software designer too, right?
I was, I'm not anymore. I stepped away from that like 6 or 7 years ago. I had been doing it for almost 25 years before that. I finally got caught by the layoff, you know, the layoff bullet finally found me. But luckily I was in a position where I could sort of prep for it. It wasn't like out of the blue. Mm-hmm. So, they let us know 6 months ahead of time that, you know, this account was going away and we either take, you know, find another job within the company or relocate within the company or take a severance package. And after talking it over with my wife, she convinced me, cause I was writing on the side, and she says, why don't you start writing full time for a while? And so I reached out to several of the editors that cultivated relationships over the years and said, you know, you've always said you would hire me more often if I was more available, but I always had to say no on, you know, there were lots of times I had to say no to a project cause I didn't have time when I was working full time. And I said, what would you do if I was available more often? And they're like, well, I'll hire your dumb ass right now. So once I lined up, you know, several projects that would get me through, you know, the first year, you know, that and the severance package, I was able to hit the ground running and not really lose any time or money. So if I wouldn't have been able to do that 10 years earlier, you know, when I was just starting out, but I'd had 10 years to build those relationships. So everybody knew me now. It's like, okay, yeah, sure. We'll give Dayton, you know, another contract. So that I've been freelance. I had been freelance writing for 4 or 5 years. And then, John Van Sitters hired me as a consultant to work for him directly. So wow. I've been doing that for about 2 years now.
Wow. So like, what is that? Some of that consulting stuff entail, like what, just ideas on shows and directions or?
I don't give ideas to the shows, but I do read all the scripts and I do a continuity read through of all the scripts. So like if they're talking about using this particular alien race or this piece of tech, or they're referencing this from this episode, I point out, you know, well, in such an episode, they did this, or, you know, this hasn't been established yet in this show, or you can't do that on this show because the writers in the other show have already beaten you to doing that. So that's the extent of my input to the shows. And, but I also read the scripts so that I can look for opportunities that might be cultivated. Like, oh, there's a dangling plot thread that might make a cool comic miniseries, or here's an idea that might make a cool scenario for Star Trek Online, or there's a prequel novel that can be written by Simon and Schuster, or here's what Modiphius can do as a guidebook or a rule book for the role-playing game. So I have relationships with people at all those major licensing partners. I have some, and I already had some of this in because I'd worked for most of them. You know, a lot of these people on the publishing side, I was like, I've worked for most of these people. So I just went in with the established relationship and I'm like, well, okay, now I'm here to help be the guy who makes sure that you're not running afoul of the writer's room. You know, when you're developing a comic miniseries or a novel miniseries or the game scenario or whatever. And so when it comes to the stuff based on the new shows, I kind of read it as sort of a triage for Kirsten Byers so that she doesn't have to spend a lot of time reading it. I read it and I summarize it and I give her all the stuff and I ask her questions based on the shows, or she refers back, and then I give it back to whoever it came from. But there's there's just the stuff that John asks me to do because he doesn't feel like doing it. So, you know, I mean, I could be writing episode synopses and marketing copy for the networks, you know, like if you go out to the app, you know, Paramount Plus, and you read about the synopses for the episode, that's mine in some form. And the Picard, did you guys see the Picard Museum exhibit when it was at conventions a few years ago?
I did.
I wrote all the stuff on the cards that went with all the artifacts.
Oh, cool.
So, but I mean, there's stuff in development from other vendors that I'm working on too, where I'm helping them guide. We're going to do something based on Discovery. Okay, well, here's where the stakes are in the ground that you can't go past. So it's an interesting job. No 2 days are the same.
We thank Dayton Ward so much for joining us here on the Collector's Corner. So as we mentioned, we're always looking to try and bring someone from behind the scenes of the things that you like to collect. So look for whatever we might come up with next for our next episode of the Collector's Corner. But for now, my name is Mike and co-host Jamie. We thank you for joining us here on the Collector's Corner.
Music for the Divine Treasury is provided by 5-Year Mission. They're writing an original song for each episode of Star Trek. Hear more of their music at 5yearmission.net. The Divine Treasury is a production of Coconut Media Works. Executive producers Bill Smith and Dan Davidson. For more great Star Trek discussion, discover the other shows of the Trek Geeks Podcast Network at trekgeeks.com or find us in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.